You could see the dust coming off of the concrete wall. When the live rounds hit, when they come down, we run. And then on that day, we regrouped, and then we were at the foot of the street that goes up to where the watchtower was, where the Israeli army was. We saw them coming down, and we saw Palestinians running from our left, so we ran through the olive groves. So when I was running, I got shot in the back of my leg, and I thought it was a tear gas canister because it felt like a blunt object hit me. But
when we're actually showing for our TV audience your leg when you were shot.
Yeah, I only saw that twice. So when I got to the clearing, the Palestinians raised me up, put me in a pickup truck, got me to the clinic, transferred me to an ambulance, and get into the hospital. We had two trucks blocking us, and then two checkpoints where they demanded to see who was inside, so it delayed my care further. But the Palestinians showed me so much care and love, and I'm indebted to them for saving me that day.
I wanted to go to Jonathan Pollack, the Israeli activist who held Aisha Noor as she died, has taken part in the weekly protests against the settlements in Beitar for months. Jonathan couldn't join us today because he's taking part in this funeral procession for Aisha Noor in Nablus. We spoke to him yesterday, and this is some of what he had to say.
I would just like to say that her death is not an isolated incident. The bullet that was shot at Aisha Noor is the exact same bullet that was shot at Amado Sison a few weeks ago, hitting him in the leg. Another American citizen hurt in exactly the same place. It is the same bullet used by Israeli forces to kill the people in Nur al-Shams and in Jenin, and these are the same bullets that killed a 13-year-old girl on the same day that Aisha Noor was killed, just a few kilometers to the south. These are the same bullets that Israel uses to perpetrate the genocide in Gaza with complete impunity. And all these bullets are provided to Israel by the American taxpayers' money. And the one thing that set this incident apart is that on Friday, American bullets killed an American citizen. And this is why we hear of it now. But it is really time for this to stop. It is time that Israel is held accountable and is forced to end its colonial regime over Palestinians and ensure Palestinian liberation. Now, that kill shot, and this soldier took a kill shot, was meant to convey a message. And that message is that any sort of Palestinian resistance to Israeli colonialism will not be tolerated. Whether it be Palestinians resisting Israeli occupation or solidarity activists standing with Palestinians as they fight for liberation. And however violent the Israeli message is going to be, our message to the Israelis is that no matter what, we will continue to stand with Palestinians in the struggle for liberation.
So that's the Israeli activist, Jonathan Pollack, who held Aisha Noor as she died. She was there then. He went in the ambulance with her to the hospital in Nablus. He described to us also how this was after the weekly protests that they hold, this weekly protest every Friday. And they were done. It was very calm when Aishanoord was shot in the head. Amado Sison, just staying with you for a moment, you were shot a month ago. What did the, you're a U.S. citizen, you're a teacher in Jersey City. What did the U.S. government do? Did you speak to the U.S. embassy?
Yeah, so it was just the U.S. embassy. They reached out when I got
shot. In Israel?
Yeah. And we filed a report. Don't have any updates about what that turned into. I did give them a report as well, consent. But no State Department, no politicians, nobody's reached out to me. And what I think is if they took it seriously that a U.S. citizen was shot a month ago, maybe Aishanoord would be here right now.
The ambassador or staff come to you in the hospital? Did the State Department here speak to you when you returned shot in the leg?
No, nothing. I heard nothing from them.
You've demanded an investigation?
I demand an investigation now for when I was shot, for Aishanoord's murder, an independent U.S. investigation, because what the Israeli report was it was a mistake shooting me. Mistakes usually come from above and down. They shot me through my right thigh, all the way through.
Well, they said they shot in the air.
They said it was a mistake. So I don't know what a mistake would be when you're pointing and shooting straight through someone's thigh. So I don't know what they're going to conclude about Aishanoord, but I know that if they investigate themselves, they will find a way to cover it up. So I want to uplift her family's demands as well.
I want to turn right now to a family that knows the pain of a daughter's death. Aishanoord Aigi had been volunteering with the International Solidarity Movement, or ISM, to try to protect Palestinians from attacks by the Israeli military and settlers. That's the same group that Rachel Corey, also a U.S. citizen, she was a student at Evergreen College in Washington, in Olympia. She was volunteering with ISM in 2003 when she was crushed to death. It was actually 3 days before the U.S. invaded Iraq. It was March 16, 2003. She was crushed to death in Gaza by an Israeli military bulldozer. She was trying to protect the home of a Palestinian pharmacist family in Rafah that was about to be demolished. She was 23. We're joined right now by Rachel's parents, Cindy and Craig Corey. After Rachel was killed, they devoted their lives to our cause, founded the nonprofit Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice. Cindy is the foundation's president, Craig the treasurer. They've also gone on interfaith peace missions to Israel, to Gaza, and the West Bank. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Cindy and Craig. I remember seeing you at Evergreen College. It was the largest graduation Evergreen ever had in Olympia that year, 2003, but it was missing one student who was supposed to have graduated, your daughter, Cindy, who was killed in Rafah. When you heard this news of Aishanoord on Friday, I was wondering your response and if you can talk about what you see as the parallels.
Thank you, Amy. And thank you to all of your guests who have shared this very tragic story. We started to get word about what had happened to Aishanoord on Friday morning. And it was, of course, very disturbing and emotional for us. I think for me, it thrusts us back to that moment on March 16th, 2003, about noon, when we were in Charlotte, North Carolina, and got the word about Rachel. And I remember, just the horror and the pain of that news. And so for me on Friday morning, I remember wondering, you know, would I ever feel whole again? Would I ever be the same person again? Could I ever enjoy life? I mean, it's a parent's nightmare. And so Friday morning, knowing that there was another family so nearby in Seattle who was getting that same kind of news was just very, very disturbing. And we continue to just feel deeply about what that family is experiencing right now.
Greg, if you can tell us, I mean, we actually just recently spoke to the two of you. You also called for an investigation. What ultimately came of the death of Rachel Corrie, killed by an Israeli military bulldozer, which was a Caterpillar bulldozer?
Well, of course, we did call for a U.S. investigation in Rachel's killing. Let me say that what we're hearing today, it's upsetting to our family to hear our State Department again. And I would expect them to say that they are trying to find out the facts and looking to Israel for that. Israel does not do investigations. They do cover-ups. So let's face it, nothing's going to come out of there that's going to help these citizens or whoever may be killed in the future. That's what we're trying to stop. Our family worked for an investigation into Rachel's killing, and we wanted some consequences out of that. And we hoped, even though we didn't know the names of the people that would be killed in the future, we hoped that that would stop, and it would not happen. I think at this point, yes, U.S. has to do an investigation, but there needs to be consequences. As Jonathan pointed out, these are American weapons that are being used. That's against U.S. law, and it should be stopped. I know from working with members of Congress and their staff, working with the State Department, that under the Leahy law, usually they're asking for proof that it was a U.S. weapon. If I write a check, I don't need proof about what's going wrong. I need people to cooperate and determine that it's not our money that's being used that way. Israel does not do that, to my knowledge. So we also need to look for international help here. I think that the UN, the International Criminal Court, they're places that need to get involved. But we're just sick and tired of hearing platitudes from the State Department. And these are people we've met. We have met with Anthony Blinken before he became Secretary of State. He's a decent person, but there needs to be consequences, and there needs to be consequences that are enforced by the entire U.S. government and the international community.
We heard those words that we hear so often when something like this happens, that the U.S. had asked for a thorough, credible, transparent investigation. We did pursue help from the State Department, from our government, and we kept pursuing that help for many years. You know, we were still getting statements in 2008 from the State Department. Michelle Bernier-Toth wrote to us about how many people in the administration at that time had spoken to their counterparts in Israel about a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation for Rachel's case. And these were people like Secretary of State Colin Powell talking to his counterpart, a long list of names that you would recognize. And at the close, she said, those requests go unanswered or ignored. And when you think about what we're doing, what we're supplying to the Israeli military, to the Israeli government, the kind of backing that's being given to them, it was just really shocking that there would be this verbal request for accountability, or at least for investigation on the part of Israel. But the U.S. acknowledged that hadn't happened. And in fact, now Secretary of State Tony Blinken in 2010 confirmed for us that the position of the U.S. government in Rachel's case remains that there has not been a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation in her case. Also, the U.S., we fought for investigation for years, U.S. investigation. We were told there's very limited statute that allows for that to happen in the U.S. The Justice Department and FBI apparently ultimately looked for that possibility, but we were told that policy impacts whether they take that on, and that even if there were investigation, prosecution of someone would be extremely unlikely through the U.S. So it's one of the reasons that we are saying there needs to be an international element here, an international commitment to ensuring that an unbiased investigation happens, that an impartial investigation happens. We ultimately went to the Israeli courts, which we learned are also implicated in furthering Israeli policy and occupation. And we heard the lead investigator who completed the military investigation. And it's important for people to understand Israel's investigations are military investigations. It became clear that that was conducted in order to exonerate the Israeli military, not to find truth and what really happened. And that's what our family was pursuing. But the lead investigator stated under oath in Haifa court that he believed that they were at war with everyone, including the peace activists from the International Solidarity Movement. I think that's really important information for people to understand now as we move forward in this tragic case.
I want to end with the words of Congressmember Pramila Jayapal of Washington, who's head of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, the largest caucus in Congress, on the killing of the Turkish-American activist Ayşenur Ezgi-Aygi. She said, "I'm very troubled by the reports she was killed by Israeli Defense Forces soldiers. The Netanyahu government has done nothing to stop settlement expansion and settler violence in the West Bank, often encouraged by right-wing ministers of the Netanyahu government. The killing of an American citizen is a terrible proof point in this senseless war of rising tensions in the region," she said. I want to thank you all for being with us. Rachel's parents, Cindy and Craig Corey, speaking to us more than two decades after Rachel was killed by an Israeli military bulldozer in Gaza near Rafah. I want to thank Amada Sison, Filipino-American, shot and led by Israeli forces a month ago today in Beita, where Ayşenur was also killed. Juliet Majid, PhD student, North Carolina State University, speaking to us from Raleigh. Dear friend of Ayşenur Aygi at the University of Washington, where they both graduated. Coming up, we look at the raids in Jenin. We'll speak with the Palestinian journalist Mariam Barghouti. Stay with us. Flowers by Samira Karubi. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We return now to the occupied West Bank, where Israeli soldiers stormed the city of Tul Quram just after midnight today, in new raids that come just days after Israeli forces withdrew from Tul Quram and Jenin. Israeli troops also raided the Balata refugee camp in the northern West Bank earlier today, and in Abu Shakdim near Ramallah. All Al Jazeera reports Israeli forces were seen raiding homes. On Friday, Israeli forces temporarily retreated from Jenin, Tulkarm, and other areas in the occupied West Bank after laying siege to the cities for 10 days, killing dozens of Palestinians, including children and elders, and leaving a trail of destruction. Simultaneous raids also took place across Nablus, Bethlehem, Hebron, and Ramallah, in the largest Israeli military occupation in the occupied West Bank in two decades, with hundreds of troops backed by armored vehicles, bulldozers, fighter jets and drones. During the raids, Israeli soldiers fired live rounds at Palestinian journalists documenting the attacks, injuring at least four of them in the town of Kafr Dam. Footage also surfaced of Israeli forces in an armored tank rolling over the dead body of an 82-year-old Palestinian man in Jenin who was killed Friday by Israeli soldiers and denied medical attention. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers continued their attacks in the West Bank. In Kariut, near Nablus, a 13-year-old Palestinian girl was killed by Israeli gunfire as settlers attacked the village. Bana Laboum was hit by a bullet Friday while she was in her bedroom. Her mother described the Israeli attack ahead of her daughter's burial.
She was in her room along with her sisters. She was afraid, in fear, and suddenly a bullet got in through the window and hit her while she was on her bed. This is what happened. There were scuffles outside with the youth, but we were surprised that a bullet came through the window and on to her.
Over 650 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank since October, nearly 150 of them children, most of them during near daily raids by the Israeli military. That's added on to the more than 40,000 Palestinians who've been killed in Gaza, and that figure is expected to be much higher, 16,000 of them children. We go now to Ramallah, where we're joined by Mariam Barghouti, Palestinian writer and journalist. Her recent piece for 972 magazine is titled Inside the Brutal Siege of Jenin. Mariam, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain what has happened there in Jenin.
Thank you for having me, Amy. So what we have seen in Jenin specifically, but generally in the northern areas of the West Bank, is an escalated attack and an offensive under the title of Operation Summer Camps by the Israeli military. And what we have seen is the Israeli military basically greenlighting the use of lethal force excessively and sporadically, which is why we're hearing news of young children being shot by bullets, as well as journalists being sniped by Israeli snipers. And what the Israeli military did was essentially bring in D9 Caterpillar bulldozers within the city of Jenin, likewise in Tulkarm within the city, and then moving deeper towards the camp, in where they bulldozed nearly the overwhelming majority of the civilian infrastructure. That includes water pipe, that includes electric wiring, that includes the sewage system. And the Israeli military basically besieged the entire city. Entry and exit was dangerous and risky because you can get shot, even as press. Medical personnel, as well as ambulances, were obstructed from moving patients, not simply banning injured persons from the camp throughout the nine-day siege, but patients from Jenin City were unable to reach the only governmental hospital in Jenin that is adjacent to the camp, and was basically placed under siege by the Israeli military. So what we saw was an intensification and a brutal offensive. Again, this is an offensive by the Israeli military under the, and I quote, it's a preemptive strike against Palestinian terrorists. But what I have seen on the ground is it was targeting essentially civilians mostly, and there was a very clear attempt to conceal what is happening from media, and that means from global audiences.
Again, you said they call this Operation Summer Camps?
Yes, so the Israeli military has called this Operation Summer Camps. It was officially declared between August 27th or 28th of last month. And the Israeli military claims that they are basically targeting refugee camps. That's why summer camps. But again, what we have seen is they're targeting civilians, and they said the refugee camps because that's primarily where Palestinian combatants are operating from. Again, this is the Israeli military going into these areas and attacking these areas. under the statement of this is a preemptive strike against terrorism. But what we have seen is a focus on the civilian infrastructure and near destruction of the refugee camps, which are Area A and under the Oslo Accords, outside the jurisdiction of the Israeli military or government.
So can you describe what Jenin was like and the level of destruction left behind? Palestinians in the camp describe being forced out of their homes by gunpoint.
Yes, so Jenin has been under constant attack by the Israeli military for the past 2 years specifically, but generally across time in Palestine. But we have seen an intensification. So every other month, the Israeli military would actually invade Jenin refugee camp and carry out lethal attacks against its community. But this time, what we have seen is that the brutality is truly unprecedented. The Israeli military, not just in the camp, but even on the outskirts, went into civilian buildings and at gunpoint forced families out of their homes to places unknown, to a fate unknown. They didn't know where they will sleep, how long they will be away from their houses. And when they returned on Friday to their homes after the Israeli withdrawal, what I saw was complete destruction of their homes and their apartments. The furniture was ruined, mattresses, they had dung on them. There were attack dogs that were put in these homes. The refrigerators would be destroyed. There would be Hebrew graffiti on the walls. And inside the camp, it's truly very difficult to capture it in words. I just saw families cleaning up the rubble, cleaning up the trash left behind by the Israeli military. The walls are full of bullets. It's just rubble all over the ground. It's so difficult to walk. Cars can't move within the camp. And the families, you know, when I would ask them, are you going to rebuild? What are you going to do now? They would respond with, why would we rebuild now if the Israeli army is only going to come for another invasion, as we have seen happen in Tul Kerem last night? Again, after a withdrawal from Tul Kerem refugee camp, the Israeli military just kept going back. So people are frightened. They feel abandoned. They have zero protection. And again, in an impoverished area to rebuild, which is going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to rebuild the infrastructure, it's truly a cost and a toll. And clearly it is put to cripple Palestinian civil society.
Mariam, can you explain who is the Jenin Brigade? What's their role in Jenin versus the security forces affiliated with the Palestinian Authority?
Right. So in Jenin refugee camp, to what the military, Israeli military dubs as the wasp's nest, we have seen a rise of Palestinian armed youth groups starting within 2021 until today. And these are small battalions. These are youth that grew up in the camp. Many of them have been imprisoned by Israel under administrative detention, meaning no trial, no charge, only torture. And they decided to take up arms, essentially, because they found that across the last decade, any efforts of Palestinians, whether it is in negotiations or whether it is an unarmed and nonviolent confrontation, has only allowed Israel to continue its expansion of settlements on Palestinian lands and continue its escalation of violence on Palestinians. So they see themselves as the force that is trying to push back. Even though they're limited in resources, they're protecting their homes. And please remember that these are the refugees that essentially Israel and its militia, its Zionist militias, had kicked out of their original homes in 1948 that are located within heartland Palestine, or what is now Israel. The difference between them and the Palestinian Authority is that the Palestinian Authority, which has been given the role of an administrative role under the Oslo Accords,
we just have 15 seconds,
has actually done nothing. Has done nothing to protect Palestinians. And actually, during the siege, remained within the headquarters, letting Palestinian families just being bombed constantly throughout the siege.
Mariam Barghouti, Palestinian writer and journalist, will link to your piece for 972 magazine, Inside the Brutal Siege of Jenin. Part two online at democracynow.org when we ask her what it's like to be a journalist reporting on Jenin.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.